Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chase. I am an alcoholic. Welcome to San Antonio, everyone. So, last month on June 10th, AA became 75 years old. That's pretty cool. So let's have a moment of silence in gratitude for the recoveries of the last 75 years. Each speaker will be speaking for 20 minutes, up to 20 minutes, for taping purposes so that we can make sure we capture the entire meeting for your recording pleasure. And without further ado, our first speaker for the Living Sober panel is Jim D. from BC, Canada.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jim D. Bolbeck, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 10th, 1984, and my home group is Back to Basics in Golden, British Columbia, Canada. We sometimes refer to ourselves as the Fossil Group. We have a member that goes from 52 years sobriety down to about 14, so you can see we've got quite a bit of sobriety in our group. When it comes to talking about living sober, the thing that I have to do is I have to go back to the number of years it took me to get into AA. I spent 14 years bouncing in and out of this program. And during that period of time, you know, I'd go to meetings, and I also bounced in and out of jail during that period of time, too. And when I was in jail, I was a very strong supporter of AA. I would go to the meetings and, you know, and it wasn't that I was looking for brownie points, because I figured out how to get out on what was called work releases. In fact, an interesting little story there is that one time I went in and I told the person that was interviewing me when I first came in, my counselor, I told him, well, I'm getting a work release. And he says, well, you're only doing 3 months. And I said, yeah, but I'm getting a work release. And he says, we don't give work releases, people doing 3 months. And I said, well, I'm getting a work release. And, you know, you have to kind of put these people into their place. So I said goodbye to him on Friday as I walked out the door. I said goodbye to him. And after that, when I went back for my, and the place that I was going to was called ARU. And that's where they sent all the impaired and people that had care and control of vehicles when they're drunk. So I would refer to it after a few visits to the establishment as Elliott River University, and I was going back for postgraduate work. But the whole thing is, I spent 14 years to get here. And during that 14 years, I would sit where I would like to be right now at the very far corner, and as soon as that meeting was over, I was out and gone. Because one of the last things I wanted was one of you idiots to grab hold of me. Because you might have some ideas that maybe I should do this and I should do that. And, you know, people made suggestions. We'll get a sponsor or that. And I just, I don't need that. I can read. So what do I need a sponsor for? I was told to do the steps. Well, I don't need to do the steps. You know, I've read them. There's no reason to do this. So I continued on the same practice for year after year after year of getting on basically a merry-go-round. The last few years of my sobriety, and actually I'd like to go to the lawyer's meeting today because I basically had a lawyer on retainer fee. And that was how I kept myself out of jail. And I didn't do a very good job of it, but, you know, I tried my best. So anyhow, that was the kind of the background to my sobriety. I didn't do anything that was suggested to me. I didn't follow the traditions. I didn't follow the steps. I didn't follow anything. I ran my own program. And I still believe today that AA is very much a personal thing. I do my program in the way that keeps me sober. But at the same time, there's some basic rules that we have to follow in this organization to get anywhere. And one of the things is actually getting yourself a sponsor. Getting involved. I tell people all the time today, one of the first things you have to do is get a sponsor, get a home group, and become involved in that home group. And those were things that I never did. because I didn't have to. I was superior to the rest of you people. And, you know, it is very, very important to do in order. So finally I came in after the last time. I got to the point where my employers had been enablers, but they decided that if I didn't get sober, I wasn't going to have a job anymore. And I wasn't worried about losing my job so much as I was, how would I afford to drink if I didn't have a job? That was what went through my mind when I first had that. And so they gave me 2 weeks. They said, well, you go out and you find yourself a treatment facility to go to. So I worked around Vancouver and I went out to all the different treatment facilities. And I finally found one that I thought was going to teach me how to drink like a gentleman. Because that's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to quit. Because what is there to do in life if you don't drink? So I walked around and I visited all these different places and I finally found one that would, I thought, cater to what I wanted. Unfortunately, the day that I got there, they kind of told me it's a little bit different. But, you know, I still went through that facility with that attitude that I was really there just to learn how to be a gentleman drinker. And, you know, I got out, I got finished, and then I thought, well, I've got to do something. And I never got involved in AA before. Excuse me. So this time when I came in, and this is why I say you have to understand my background getting here. I decided when I came in the last time that I was going to follow what you people told me to do. And that was really quite a, you know, quite an astonishing thing for me to say, well, you know, I've tried my own for 14 years. It hasn't worked. So I thought, well, I've been to jail quite a bit of the time, so I wanted to go into jail meetings. And I looked into that, and you had to have 6 months sobriety to get into Ocala, and I didn't have 6 months sobriety. But anyhow, I was told of this one meeting where the gentleman ran it himself, and it was a very good meeting to go to, and that's what I did. I started there at that group, and it actually became my home group for several years, and I got involved in it. I became the GSR for the group. I went to the meetings. The person that ran the meeting actually kind of put his arm around me and dragged me along and said, well, this is what you have to do. And he became my first sponsor. But, you know, I worked there for a long time. And I got into, at one point, I was going into Ocala, I was going into ARU, I was going into Wellington, and I was going into New Haven. I had four institutions I went into. And that was what I did. That was my kind of my first service work. And that kept me sober because one of the things that I really found interesting is I could go into one of those meetings, and at the end of that meeting, I could get up and walk out. And, you know, that was a great thing for me, to be able to walk out of that meeting at the end of it. And especially when I went into Ocala, where I did the PC for quite some time. And I could go in there, and I could rattle the doors that, you know, after I'd been there and the meeting was over, I'd rattle the doors and I'd yell, guard up, and God, they came and let me out of the place. And it was the greatest feeling. And actually, that kept me sober for a long time. And I did mention about when I first came in, about bouncing in and out of this place called ARU. And this one guard, he called me Diabolical. It was a play on my last name. And he was the one that told me I wasn't going to get a work release. We went out there one time and I was on the roundup for the prison meetings. And we took the guest speaker out there. And who do I run into but this guard? So I started talking to him. It's really funny because I thought the guy was a complete idiot, because he was. And, you know, there is no, you know, there's nothing that I could do to make him any better. But it was really surprising. My sobriety did actually improve his way of looking at things, because he was actually quite a nice gentleman. I spent there for a whole hour talking to him. And we got along great, you know, but it was just the fact that I had sobered up that he had changed his personality. That, you know, that had to be what it was. And another thing about going into the institutions like that, so I signed up to become a sponsor of taking inmates out to meetings. And again, at one point, the fellow that ran this ARU institution, he called me up and he said, Jim, I see your name's on the list here. Would you come out for a interview for taking people out to meetings to learn the ins and outs from the other side of the position. So I went out there and talked to him, and he says, yes, Jim, he says, I have an ideal person here for you. He says, he's got a chip on his shoulder, just like you. And he says, but you didn't have a chip, and he doesn't have a chip. He says, you got the whole tree, roots and all. And that was the way they looked at me when I was there. I was really a snarly drunk. I wasn't a very easy person to get along with. So anyhow, I got into doing service work involved in the prison system. I eventually moved out of the greater Vancouver area, and I continued on as GSR and that. But to me, the whole thing about this program is we got to do the steps. And, you know, the steps are set out 1 to 12. That's how they're got to be done. You also have to get into the traditions and study the traditions, because the steps got me sober. The traditions keep me connected to AA, and it also is for the health of AA in general. And believe it or not, the traditions work very well in your own life. And again, I had to bring this whole program into my life to stay sober. And that is the way I look at living sober. I can do anything I want, but I always have to remember that what keeps me sober is AA. And today, you know, I look at things, and gratitude is one of the topics I really hate to speak on. Because when people say gratitude, and I say, well, I've only got one thing I'm grateful for, and that is the fact I'm an alcoholic. Because if I was not an alcoholic, I would not need this program. If I did not need this program, I would not have the steps, the traditions, and the concepts in my life. And I feel sorry for people out there in the regular straight world today, because they don't have this wonderful program behind them. And I've got everything that I can talk about came to me because I sobered up. There isn't a thing that I have today that I would have if I was still drinking. In fact, I would not be alive today. So when it comes to living sober, to me, you have to work the program. I know at home, my home group, they kind of get tired of listening to me because I keep preaching on doing the steps, doing the traditions. And I like to point out to people that for me, my idea of doing the steps is you're never going to do them perfect, so why worry about it? Get in and do them. And if you've been in for AA for 2 or 3 years, I say you're taking too long on those steps. And that is the way I come across with my program, because AA started in 1935. They didn't put out the book, big book, in 1955. They put out the big book within almost immediately after AA started. And that is the way we have to do our steps. We come into this program. We get involved. We do our steps. We study the traditions. And that's the only thing I can do, is I keep harping on the same thing. Work the program. Join a home group. Become active in it. I learned how to argue with people through AA, because there's two ways to do things when I was drinking. That was my way and the wrong way. And when I came into AA, I learned there's a few more ways to do things. So again, I had to learn. Basically, I had to learn from what most people would have learned in junior high school all the way up to where I quit drinking at. I came in here basically the mental capacity of socially probably a 12-year-old kid. I remember, and this is jumping back a little bit, but going back into, I think it was grade 8, they actually handed out this little thing that's actually the 12 questions in those days. They've expanded it since then. And you were to check off at what you'd done and all that, and have you ever lost time from this. I went through that. I came out, I was quite proud of myself. I had something like 80%. But that was not the way the score was supposed to go. So, you see, I was drinking at that point. I got into blackout drinking by time I was 16. There's a lot of part of my life that I can't actually recall, because it was in an entire blackout. And, you know, so that is why I'm so emphatic on doing things as the program sets them forth. Because I had to learn to live in this program. You people taught me how to live. You taught me how to do things. And to do it, I have to work the program. That's all I can say is, do your steps, do your traditions. And, you know, eventually I'm now starting to study the concepts, and they're very important. I like to, our home group makes a very big issue of, the three-legged stool. And they say, well, you can't sit on a one-legged stool, which is very true. And that is why I say my program has 36 steps. Because you all know what it's like when you're sitting on a one-legged stool. You don't sit very well. Eventually you fall over. And I know I had a lot more lined up to say, and I went through my little speech here, and it did make 20 minutes. But, I have to admit that I'm very, very nervous. When I came here, I thought I was going to be sitting in, you know, maybe a room that would hold maybe 60, 70 people. And I do have to talk to the people that organized this, because they're going to be, I'm going to refer to them as the late people, because when I get finished with this, that I would like to meet them, and they'll soon be people that passed on. But anyhow, I'm here and enjoying my life, and all I can say is, do your program, you know. Get in there. Get involved. Become a GSR. Be a DCM. Go into prisons. Go to a treatment centers. Go anywhere. But get out there and start passing this message on. Do your steps. Do your traditions. And then pass it on. Because you don't know, at least I didn't know very much until I started to get a little bit of a background. I could go there. I could tell my story. But after I got a bit of a background into the functioning of AA, I became more of a functioning member of it. And basically, I don't know how many minutes I've used up here. I hope it's fairly close to my 15. I'm right at 15 now, so I've got 5 minutes to go. So I'm basically just going to wind down here and say thank you very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed coming down here. I still get some resentments. I got a resentment at the border the other day. I drove up to the border, and I flew out of Spokane, and I drove up to the border, and that's the first time being across since they brought out this deal of having to have passports and all that, and I got my passport. I hadn't gone around to getting a clearance from the U.S. government or whatever it is that you need to come into the country, so I drove up there, and I didn't know how it was going to go. So the first thing I asked the guard when I got there, I said, what do you want, my driver's license or my passport? He said, well, I forget what he said. It was either whatever or doesn't matter. I gave him my passport, and he took a look at it, and that was it. So I looked at him. You know, like, I hadn't been in there for 30 seconds. So I looked at him and said, is that all you're going to do? So he kind of said, well, do you want me to do any more? But, you know, the funny thing is I did actually get kind of resentment at that fellow. I thought, well, you know, I've been told about how much problem it is to get into the States and how they check this and they check that. And the drive up there and the guy basically waved me through. I just didn't think that was right. But I really love your city of San Antonio here. I'm glad to see everybody come. I'm really glad to be a member of AA. And I hope you people enjoy the association with AA as much as I do. And just have a wonderful time here this weekend. Enjoy yourself, and as I say, get involved, because to live sober, I have to keep AA the prime part of my life. There's other people that say, you know, they put in a few years, and, you know, they don't need meetings and all that afterwards. I'm not one of those, because I have to keep my pulse on the people that keep me sober. And, you know, I've met too many people that talk about knowing somebody, or I've even met people, you know, they've had 15, 20 years in, and they've gone out and got drunk. And one of the main things I've always found out is they've quit going to meetings, quit being active. And for me, I have to stay active because I want to stay alive. So thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
You know, I'm not, thank you very much, that was awesome. I am not going to share between speakers. What was interesting, I brought my letter that they sent me when they asked me to do this, and it says, Dear Chase, I'm not going to read you the whole letter. But it says, most chairpersons share briefly their own experience, strength, and hope between speakers. And I'm not going to do that. And there's some people in here that know me well, and that's really interesting to get me at the microphone and say, go ahead and share between speakers. Not a good idea. So I'm going to share a little bit afterwards for a few minutes, but my list of speakers is, hold on. No, this is really truly an international convention. It really is. We have one speaker from the United States today in this panel, and we just heard from a speaker from BC, and we have a speaker from South Africa also today in this panel, so that's cool. So our next speaker I can't read my own writing. It's Ponca City, Oklahoma, Deb G.
Buenos tardes and good afternoon, San Antonio. I had to work on that one. My name is Deb G, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 15th, 2002, and my home group is the Freedom Group in Ponca City, Oklahoma. It consists of 7 active members, so this is pretty big. 4 of our members are actively in service work on the district and area level, so we've got 50% in service. Our meetings run generally from 12 people up to 20, and that's standing room only. So this is pretty big. Anyway, the letter that I got said the topic was living sober, and that's going to be the focus of what I'm going to talk about today. Mike, Sherry, Tracy, Andrew, and Julie. Mike was my first cousin, and he was the first one to die. He killed himself with carbon monoxide poisoning on Thanksgiving weekend in his garage. His note was, I bit off more than I could chew. He was my first cousin on my mother's side. The second person was my only sister, Sherry. She had 7 years in the program, and she quit going to meetings. She died of a heroin overdose in a cheap small hotel in Seattle, Washington. Tracy was the third to go. She was my cousin on my father's side. And if there is such a thing as overkill, Tracy did it. She took a bottle of pain medication together with a packet of white powder, chased it with a quart of vodka. She filled up a Hollywood tub, took 2 cinder blocks, put one on her abdomen and one on her chest, and cut her wrists. Her note that she wrote on the bathroom mirror was, I can't stand the pain. The police thought that her new fiancé had possibly killed her because the cinder blocks are so heavy. They didn't know how she could really get herself in the tub and get the blocks on her body. But they dismissed that later. Andrew was the next to go, and he is the next generation on my mother's side. He was 11 years old, and he hung himself from his bunk bed. Now, the last to go was Julie, my cousin Julie, and she died a year ago, this last November 6th, in Houston, Texas, from a drug and pain pill overdose. Her heart stopped beating. Now, Julie was a 2-time cancer survivor, but her alcoholism killed her. I always get teary-eyed when I say this. Now, I'm the oldest of that group of relatives, and I always thought that my name should be on that list. And instead, I found the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found a sponsor who made me work the steps. But being the alcoholic that I am, I decided that I could make a more concise, succinct note if I was going to kill myself. And that would have been, life stinks. That's all it was. And that's how I felt. My life stunk. And I don't know about the kind of alcoholic you all are, but I'm the kind of alcoholic that could start a kajillion projects and never finish one. Unless it had a cork in it, I could finish that all the time. So after 4 years of sobriety and relying strictly on the fellowship to support me, I started college at 52, and I was full of fear. I didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I could learn. And at one of the Icky Paw conventions that I listened to a CD, this one lady said, courage. To have courage is to do what you are afraid of anyway. And so I started school. And it took the first semester to blow the cobwebs out of my brain and to learn how to study. And I felt very uncomfortable because I was older than the professors and definitely older than all the students. But after the first year, and I found that I made friends with some of the young students and made great friends with the professors. So I have an associate's degree in English, and I'm working on the bachelor's degree right now. You know, today I feel truly blessed that I am called a non-traditional student. It's like they kind of like us too. The professors, they kind of like us. In March, late February, early March, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was advised to drop my classes. Well, I stuck to it and I made it through. And with God's help and Gary, my significant other's help, I got through 4 English courses and writing 1,000-word papers, and it was not fun. So I'm enrolled for next semester in school, but I think I'm just going to drop it to 6 hours because I have learned through AA that I have to listen to my body as well as able to listen to my mind. Also, 4 years ago, I started an eBay store, something I was scared of. I thought, I don't know if I can sell anything. I buy stuff on there all the time. And my eBay store, I'm a top-rated power seller, and it is my sole support of income now. And it's a family affair. My dad is in the oil field, and he went to all these oil field auctions, so he took me to art auctions and glass auctions and taught me how to buy. And Gary, he packages everything that I buy. And then we all come home and we unwrap it and we reveal these treasures. And Gary's brother Bill takes pictures of them so I can put them on my eBay store. And it's so much fun to find something that's old and discarded and somebody's trying to replace a memory and they treasure it again. I find it's kind of like us. We were all discarded from society and now we're members and parts of, and good people. Okay. Back around the time when I started the eBay store and school, I got a new sponsor. My first sponsor never had me work the steps. Okay, so my second sponsor, Betty, she's one of those old school sponsors. Like if you called her up on the phone and you didn't have your big book in your hand, she'd slam the phone down. So it was exactly what I needed, and she diligently started me on the steps. She goes, what have you read in the big book? I said, the story's in the back. I think she had her first heart attack at that time. You know, I'm not sure, but so I had only been involved in the fellowship of the program. I hadn't in the fellowship, not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not the 12 steps. And, that was killing me. It was killing me. And it's something that I needed to address. And I had a spiritual experience. And what brought the spiritual experience about is a man named Roger. And Roger is one of my friends who just got here. He was her love of her life, just like Gary is for me. And Roger had colon cancer, and he had 10 years in the program. Well, Roger just floored me. He had such dignity and grace. And the night before he died, he was in his room, and he was writing his gratuity list. I'm like, what? you're grateful, you're dying. I didn't get it. But he was writing, most of the things I remember is he was writing Stacy's name a lot. And then he was writing like sobriety, and he was writing things like insurance. And I asked my service sponsor, Keith, I said, Keith, I don't get it. And he goes, well, Roger practiced his principles in all of his affairs. And I still didn't get it at that time. But all of us, we all leave nuggets of knowledge for everybody else to pick up. Roger left me one, and when I picked it up, it burnt my soul. Because I knew I didn't have what he had. And I wanted it. That's when I got the sponsor. So Roger was my spiritual experience. He was the catalyst who got me busy on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He saved my life. The fellowship saved my soul. 12 steps saved my life. Then, I'm sorry, I get real emotional. let's see. Now I'm lost. Oh, no, I had to turn it over. I had to take notes because I was really embarrassed and very nervous. In last May, AA and God sent me an angel, and he came to my home group meeting, and his name is Gary, and he came from Portland, Maine, to Ponca City, Oklahoma. He came home to his roots. He likes to say that alcoholism dropped him off in Portland, Maine for about 20 years, and sobriety brought him back to his roots. Well, you know, Gary is the man that makes my heart sing and my soul smile. He's my split apart. He's what God picked for me. I couldn't have done it any better. And it reminds me of how close God is active in each of our lives. You know, God does not leave the smallest thing undone when you let him run the show. And that's a clue for me. And God knew that I'd need support for what I was getting ready to go through. And Gary's got 12 years in the program, and he works as an alcohol and drug counselor in Tonkawa, Oklahoma, with low-bottom drunks and meth heads that we have in Oklahoma. I don't know if you have them in San Antonio, but we have them in Oklahoma. So, as I said, that in late February, early March, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And Gary and I have been through 3 bouts of chemo. We do the 4th bout on Tuesday after we leave here. And Gary has been with me every step of the way. He's my rock. And he brings a book he loves to read. And he's reading me Wind in the Willows while I'm going through chemo. And all the nurses think that's really cute. And it's got great illustrations, and I love it. So after that, I have 6 chemos to do, and then I have 6.5 weeks of radiation, and then I'll be on some medication for 5 years. But in all of this, I have found that my type of cancer is easier than the alcoholism I had. You know, I'm going to take a pill, and the cancer will be okay from now on after I get through this. And I always thought I wished I could have given pills to my relatives that died. I wish there was a pill, but there is a pill. It's called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in the first 164 pages. We just have to digest it, and sometimes we just gloss over it. I have a cancer sponsor. They have kind of my oncologist's wife, Allison, went through cancer 10 years ago. And they're both from Scotland, and they have the greatest accents, and I just love them to death. And she tells me the truth about what happens to my body and what's going to happen and what to really expect. And I just, you know, I'm thankful to God because God puts people in your life when you need them. And I see that that's exactly what he's doing with me. He's, you know, he's always watched over me. But I was so full of myself that I never paid attention to him. You know, he would whisper to my soul, but my head was going so fast I couldn't even hear my own self think, much less any words of advice he tried to give me. So today I'm able to listen to my body and my soul and pay attention to both of them. And for that, I'm grateful. The first 8 years of sobriety, I was able to I bought a house last year. I just bought a new car. The love of my life shows up. You know, wow. And, you know, he asked me to marry him last November 12th. And we kind of got put off because I was a pre-existing condition. So, and you know how that goes. This is lots of money. So we hope to be married next year after, I call myself cancer girl, after I finish my treatment. So that's what we're hoping. Another God thing is Stacy, my friend, she works for the state of Oklahoma, and she found this program called BCCP. It's the Breast and Cervical Cancer Program. And it's paid for by the smoking tax. Don't go figure, I don't know. But anyway, the smoking tax is paying for breast cancer. I don't get it, but I don't mind. And I have to pay a $3 copay each time I go, and that's it. So what a miracle is that? I mean, $3. I write the check. I said, you better hold this for a while. It might bounce, you know. So, you know, God is so good. I can't imagine what the next 8 years of my sobriety is going to be like with what's happened the first 8. Now, I like to close with this last thing, and it's a Robert Frost poem, and it's a few lines, and it's called The Road Not Taken. And it says that two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Well, you see, unlike my relatives, I took the path to AA, and that has made all the difference. And that's how I'm standing here today, and their memory lives on through me telling you about them. If you're new to the program, get a sponsor, get a home group, get involved in service work, and get out of yourself and get into other people. The first 4 years of my sobriety, I was pretty dry, I guess, because I relied on the fellowship. It was the program and the 12 steps that made the last 4 years of my life really what's worth living. That's it. Thank you.
And our next speaker is Detlef P. from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Detlef. I am an alcoholic. And I'm a very grateful member of this fellowship. I find it very difficult to put in words how I really feel. First of all, you will notice that I speak English with a strong German accent. But I speak German without an English accent. My home group is in Johannesburg, South Africa, where I spent all my adult life and much of my drinking. But my drinking career started fairly early in life. I hear people in the fellowship speaking about the invisible line. I don't know, I must have been born on the other side. Of course, as long as I remember, I was different. I wasn't who I wanted to be. I wasn't where I wanted to be. I always wanted to be somebody else, somewhere else, but most not, definitely not the one in me. And so I left home at the age of 13. I left Germany at the age of 18. And I basically never went back. And I had a fairly interesting career in my drinking. I first went to Switzerland. And after 6 months in Switzerland, I was asked by a judge to leave. They thought Switzerland would be a better place without me in it. So I traveled on. I went to France, and I didn't like drinking red wine. I carried on. I went to Sweden, and in Sweden, things were different, and I stopped drinking already for the first time after I left Switzerland, with the purpose of never picking up another drink. But of course, it didn't happen. I had to pick up a drink if I'm an alcoholic. I joined the Merchant Navy, and that was beautiful. I went around the world a few times. I went to New York City for the first time in 1959. And I remember being on the ship, and we were about an hour before we docked at the harbor. And I wanted to go on to the Empire State Building. And I put on my best suit, and I dressed up real smart, and I brushed my teeth and combed my hair, and I looked really good. And it was a perfect day. The sun was shining, and I worked everything out on the map. I said, I walk up 48th Street, and if I come to Broadway, I turn right. And, you know, I knew everything what to do. And on the way to the Empire State Building, I came past a little bar. And I thought, you know, to make a good day a perfect day, to make something, I had one drink. I thought. I didn't make it to the Empire State Building this time. But the next time I most definitely will try. I came to New York 7 times. Many, many years later, I had to join AA to be in on the Empire State Building for the first time. And so my trip went around the world, and you know, I went to many different places. I went to the Virgin Islands. I didn't find any virgins there. I traveled on, and I came to New Zealand. And when I came down to the harbor, the boat was gone. And I didn't know, was the boat gone for an hour, a day, a week? It just was gone. But I wasn't much concerned about it. My concern was more, where do the next drink come from? You know, and that's a real problem, sitting in a foreign country without any resources. And so I made myself as representable as possible, and I went into the next restaurant, and I said, are you looking for a chef? And funny enough, they said yes. And I started working the next day, you know. And I worked for a while, and after 3 months, and I promised myself I'm never going to drink again. Never, ever. And I didn't drink for a couple of months. And a man from the tax office came to the restaurant and said, are you Mr. Peineke? I said, yes. He said, you know, we receive every month an income tax from you, but we can't find you anywhere on the papers. He said, where are your immigration papers? I said, I haven't got any. So that was the second country they asked me to leave. and that's how it carried on. And eventually I went down to Africa, and Africa was a great place. It's a beautiful country, and the sun is shining, and, you know, wherever you pass out, it won't be too cold, you know, so. But every time I changed countries, and I changed countries often, I was determined to start a new life. And I always thought, booze will not be a part of it. And I remember the day I sat on an airplane going down to South Africa, and that was a far trip. Of course, I came from Berlin. We went from Berlin to Frankfurt, from Frankfurt to Cairo, from Cairo to Kinshasa, I think, so, and then down to Johannesburg. That even with the airplane those years, it took 3-4 days, you know. And I remember sitting in the plane and saying, I'm going to start a new life. I'm never going to drink again. I didn't realize I was not able to. I didn't know. I really tried hard. I just couldn't stay stopped. So life went on, and at the age of 36, I was married with 2 children, a lovely wife. And my parents from Germany, my mother and my stepfather came out and visited us. Of course, last baby was born. And my mother saw what the situation really was. And she told my wife, you know what, you got a beautiful home, you got two beautiful children, you got a good education, you got a good job, get rid of my son. That hurts, you know. I thought my mother loved me. But I understood, and it was right, and I wanted so much, and I realized so much that I wasn't the husband I was supposed to be. Not that I didn't want it to. When I got married, I really meant it when I said that I will look after my wife. I wanted to be a good son to my mother. I wanted to be a good father to my children. I just couldn't, you know. So I made a decision. I'm going to phone AA. Now, that wasn't easy, of course. Where to start? And I spoke to my wife, and my wife, I don't know if she found the number of AA or I found it. And I phoned AA, and I spoke to a gentleman in the information office, and he said, okay, fine, where do you live? And I told him, and he said, okay, there are meetings in that place and that place. I said, no, you misunderstood. You know, I'm not a common drunk. I don't want to go to meetings and mix with real alcoholics, you know. Can't I come to the head office? And he's, you see, I'm not stupid. I know if you want something done, you speak to the people in charge. So he said, fine, you can come to the office. We open from 10 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. I said, 4 is a little bit early. Can't we make it 4:30? And he said, listen, if you promise me to come, I will wait until 4:30. I had nothing important to do. It was just my character to see how far can I push people. I dressed up the next day very smartly. I had a three-piece suit on. I had a beautiful white shirt. I looked stunning. I polished my shoes a couple of times. I brushed my teeth. I made sure I was well-shaven. And I thought, you know, if they see me walking in like that, they will say, you're not really an alcoholic, you know. Another thing is that I took my wife along. I thought, you know, she can bail me out that I'm not that bad. I never rearranged the furniture. I never gave her a hiding. Sometimes I think she looked for one, but she never got a hiding for me. And I had all the answers prepared for what this gentleman is going to ask me. And when I came there, he asked me nothing. He told me his story. And I listened, and I thought, wow, if he can do it, there's hope for me. And we went to a meeting the next day, and there were three speakers like tonight. And the one impressed me so much. The moment the meeting stopped, I went to my wife and I said, you know, if I keep coming to AA, I will be all right. If I do what the people tell me to do, I will be all right. And I was prepared to do anything. So I kept on coming to AA. And at the second meeting, somebody actually made himself my sponsor. I didn't ask him. He just came up and he said, you knew? And I said, yes. He said, you think you can stop drinking for a day? I said, a day? No problem. I said, a week is hard, but a day I can do. He said, no, don't, no week, just one day. I said, fine. He said, okay, if you come home tonight, you close your eyes and you pray. And I said, who to? And she said, don't worry, it goes to the right address. And he said, and by the way, if you take off your shoes, put your shoes deep under the bed. And tomorrow morning, if you're looking for your shoes, he said, that's a good time to pray again, if you're on your knees. And I followed his instructions and I'm still doing it. And that was in December 1978. And I haven't had a drink since. And I'm still married to the same wife. My wife joined Al-Anon. I think she got a black belt now. Life after coming into AA became so much better. Actually, looking back, I think until that stage I was existing, and now I started living. Some beautiful things happened, but also sad things happened. Our son, I was 1 year in the fellowship, was diagnosed that he had severe brain damage. And he is going to be spastic. And I was sitting in the doctor's office, and for a split second, I thought, I'm going to drink. But before the thought even was finished, I said, going to drink won't make things better. If the doctor would have told me you drink a case of whiskey, I probably would have done it in record time. But it wasn't the solution. So life in the fellowship got its ups and downs. In place of that, I went home and I went on my knees and I prayed. And I prayed very hard. And I didn't pray to God to make my son perfect. I prayed to him to give me the strength to be there for my son if he needs me. I prayed that if he wants to go to the toilet, that I will be there. And I prayed and said, I want to work so hard and do everything I possibly can. If anywhere in the world there will be somebody who can help my son, I want to be able to afford that he can have an operation. And then, miracles starting. At the age of 3.5, my son started walking. Barely, but he walked. Two years later, another miracle happened. We heard of a doctor who made a very unique operation. He opened the spine and he worked on the nerves going to the feet to release the spastic feelings. And my son, for the first time, was able to sit on a chair. And there, even in all that time, one miracle after the other. Today, my son is a grown-up son of 32. He got 4 university degrees. He walks with a bad limb, but he is there. And I tell you this story, not of course that you feel sorry for anybody. I tell you this story, of course, I don't think there is any excuses or reasons to drink. There might be excuses. Some of them good, some of them not so good, but they remain excuses. And I hear very often in the fellowship, people's newcomers coming in and they're having a slip. And I say, well, why do you have a slip? Oh, I lost my job. How much you have to drink before you find a job? Was it coming in and to say my mother-in-law died? I understand it's a good reason to celebrate. But you only can celebrate once. So, you know, I think people don't take the program serious enough. I was prepared to really do anything. And when I came in, I couldn't speak English very well. And I had a big book in English. And I had a dictionary. And I went word to word. And I envied these English-speaking people coming in. And they say, and on page 85 of the big book, I was busy with page 7 for the last 2 weeks. You know. But I just tell you, of course, it is possible to do what you have to do. If you want to stay sober, this is what makes it possible. For me, life now, it's AA. And AA is my life. Everything I have, everything I do is around AA. How much longer have I? I'm very glad both my children live now in America, and that's why we come on a regular basis here. Both my children have never seen me drinking. My daughter was 4 years old when I came into the fellowship, and I remember what she doesn't remember. One day, my wife was crying again, for no reason, probably. and my daughter came to me, and she kicked me in my shin. And she said, "You make my mommy cry." You know, and I don't want to forget it. Of course, I didn't want it. I wanted to be a good husband. I wanted to be a good father, a good son to my parents. And I disappointed everybody, especially myself. Thank you very much.
Chase Alcoholic. Chase. You know, my experience living sober and working the steps and being a part of this fellowship is totally interwoven with my experience being of service in the fellowship. I can't separate the two. They're counterparts to each other. And one of my favorite pieces of our literature is a portion of our service manual called "Why Do We Need a Conference?" And it was written by the late chair of the board, Bernard Smith, who was one of the architects of our general service structure. And he mentions in this piece, and I'll say, when I say conference, I really mean service. I'll actually just say service. He says, we may not need service to ensure our own sobriety, but we need it for the alcoholic who stumbles in the dark just a short few blocks from this room. And he goes on to talk about and we need service to make sure that the fellowship is here for the alcoholics being born tonight. And I just got a lot going on through my head. I have all weekend. My son was born 6 weeks ago. He'll be 6 weeks old tomorrow. And it's really cool. If I had a huge jumbo screen to show you, I've been showing everybody his picture. I might corner you and show you his picture. I mean, hey, look at Weston. He's really cute. And I'm a member of AA, and my wife is a member of AA, and little Weston is a member of AA. Because if you can engineer and create an alcoholic, we have done that. I'm sure. He looks just like me, but he drinks like his mother. I had to say that. So, a saying that I've heard that would capture my idea about living sober the best for me is that happiness is not a destination, it's a mode of travel. And that's kind of how I try to live. And we've all traveled here. We had a lot of travel. I got travel on my mind, I got family on my mind, and
And I think about movement and travel and all that, because a lot of us have traveled from all over the place to be here. And what's interesting, I was thinking about this earlier, that I wonder, I think there's like 50,000 AA members here. I can't even get my head around that. But I wonder, I'll bet you that not one of the 50,000 people that are here for this conference this weekend showed up in here in a blackout. And woke up here, oh, I'm in San Antonio, wow. At the AA International. But can you imagine if there is one of our wonderful brothers or sisters here that did wake up in a blackout here? What a cool place to wake up to. Speaking of that, I used to tell my part of my story. I used to say that, you know, I can't just mow my lawn and drink a beer. You know, my brother, I would say at the time, can mow his lawn and drink a beer with impunity. I cannot do that. If I do that, I wake up in another time zone in your car with a microwave on my lap. And I have this look on my face like, this was really worth it. Something happened and I know it was cool. And my brother called me one night 2.5 years ago and he said, I've got a drinking problem. And anyway, and I said, but Glenn, no, that's part of my story. You can't do that. You can drink beer and mow your lawn. He said, well, you better get a different story then. Well, he's here. He's 2.5 years sober. And yeah. So it's just an incredible journey. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know anything different. That's all I've known for 15 years. And I am just such a big fan of AA. I feel like I'm with the most fortunate people on the planet every day of my life when I hang out in AA. So I love you and thank you. And let's give our wonderful panelists a hand.